The Tom Woods Show, episode 2034.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Don't forget, you can get one of my books in audiobook format for free. So that includes my book, Real Dissent, which is narrated by me. My New York Times bestseller, Meltdown on the Financial Crisis of 2008, featuring a foreword by Ron Paul, Nullification, and others. Just head over to tomwoodsaudio.com, sign up for Audible, and if you decide you don't want Audible, you get to keep the free audiobook they give you anyway. tomwoodsaudio.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We round out 2021 on the Tom Woods Show with our old friend Alan Mendenhall, who teaches at the Sorrell College of Business at Troy University, where he is also associate dean. And we're talking about his new book, Shouting Softly, Lines on Law, Literature, and Culture. Alan, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be back on your show.
You are a very active guy. I see you on Facebook all over the place doing all kinds of interesting and exciting things. And you're such a young guy. I'm sorry to ask you a personal question right off the bat, but I'm dying to know how old you are. Do you mind if I ask you that?
I don't mind at all. I am 38.
All right. Well, you, I don't know how you got to where you are at age 38, but good for you is all I can say. Good for you. All right. I want to talk about, you have here a book of essays on quite a variety of topics. You're just like me in that, although you can speak about particular topics at some length, you want to talk about a lot of things. This is why, as a U.S. historian, I could just never, ever get around to being a specialist in one particular area, because by the time I really had read everything, I wanted to move on to something else. I have opinions on a lot of things, not just on the cultural history of the U.S. in the 20s. That would make me crazy. So I like a book like this that takes me all over the place to where the author is thinking and what he's interested in. But let's start with part one, because law, of course, is an area that's very dear and important to you. And in the essays in here on law, I would say there's a similar theme running through most of them. And it has to do with a couple of different ways that we might think about the Constitution. Now, here I'm not thinking about the nationalist versus the compact theory, but I'm thinking instead about whether the Constitution is pointing toward some kind of goal for us, whether it's frankly ideological, whether it's making ideological demands of us in the way we organize our society, or whether it's just setting out ground rules and leaving it to us to decide what our values ought to be. Do you think I'm describing it okay?
I think that's perfect. I love that. Yeah, I mean, I tend to frame that entire first section on law in terms of nomocratic jurisprudence versus teleological jurisprudence. And nomos is the ancient Greek concept of laws derived from convention and custom and consensus. And I see it as a bottom-up rulemaking and standards process. So we're talking spontaneous order, decentralization, diffusion and dispersal of power, emergent processes, custom, tradition, situated and embedded norms, restraints on power, dividing power, and a focus on the historical and the local rather than the ahistorical and the centralized. Now, by contrast, you have the teleological approach, which is that law is working inexorably towards some ideal end state or final cause that conforms with pure reason or natural law or whatever it may have. But it's, like you say, ideological. The nomocratic view is against abstraction and toward concrete facts. It's not that it rejects things like natural law. It's just that natural law is revealed through historical analysis, and it's only ever imperfectly known because of the complexities and messiness of human experience and fallibility. So it's against utopianism. It's against ideology. And it relies on the tried and tested rather than the untried and the new.
Well, it's interesting that I can jump all the way from your first essay all the way to the second to last essay and find a theme running through it. Because your second to last essay is, no one knows what change and equality mean. And here's a key thing. Now, change we'll leave out for a minute, but equality, the problem with equality and saying that the Constitution commits us to equality is precisely that it's such a slippery concept that means something different to everybody, and that there's almost no kind of equality that can ever be permanently achieved. It is the engine on which this generally teleocratic style of jurisprudence. It's the gasoline that powers that engine. Because, of course, if you have a goal that can never be reached, well, you can just keep on rearranging society and rearranging it and experimenting on people and engineering them over and over and over infinitely, because you'll never, ever reach that goal. But the presence of the goal empowers bureaucrats to do arbitrary and oppressive things in the name of a nice-sounding word.
Well, I agree. And the basic concept of equality is fundamentally at odds with the basic concept of diversity, which is what's so interesting about people on the left who purport to champion both, because even at a fundamental level, we recognize that every human being is inherently different. We have different talents. We have different interests. We're physically different. We have different capacities to know. And we all sort of recognize that no two people are the same. And we embrace this reality as a good thing, that we're all distinct, we're all unique. And yet, equality would hold us up as somehow standardized or uniform. Essentially, what makes us unique as people is obliterated by the institutionalization of anything that magnifies equality as the summum bonum. So I find equality and diversity to be completely incompatible concepts, yet they are both central to what the progressive left champions today.
Let's go back to that first section. Stephen Breyer as a Supreme Court justice is a topic I want to ask you about, because apparently, as you say, which I hadn't realized, over the course of his career, he's become much less interesting and much more bland. And I'm curious about that process. I mean, when I saw his nomination, I mean, I thought to myself, this is basically a typical center-left judge. I can probably predict where he's going to come down on everything. He's not a Marxist revolutionary, and he's not a conservative. He's a reliable center-left, pro-regime kind of judge. What else can you say about him?
Well, I think his 2005 book, Active Liberty, was much more interesting in that it got into legal hermeneutics and just his interpretive philosophy. And he talked a lot about negative liberty and positive liberty and what these meant, and about utilitarianism and all kinds of interesting philosophical questions. But, you know, some of his recent books have been more designed for a popular audience, but yet written for a scholarly audience. And so there's a little bit of disconnect in tone versus audience. But by the same token, I think he's just sort of out of date. He tends to champion, for instance, looking to foreign laws as a legitimate exercise for judges, not as binding sources of law, but as persuasive sources. And regardless of what you think about that, his opinion of Europe is very outdated. He tends to look at the Europeans as being sort of far in advance of the United States and their progressive leftist views. And he is completely oblivious to the rise of populism in Europe and the rise of populist political candidates. I don't know what he would think about the current French election that's going on and their right-wing candidate, but he just seems to have an outdated view of Europe as being just fixed in place in like 1970s, where it's all about sort of the UN Declaration of Human Rights and the old welfare state socialist model, which I think Europe is frankly moving away from all that now. I mean, it's in a very disruptive period and no two European states are alike. And we've had Brexit since then. And you've got other European countries talking about secession or different forms of dissolution. So the Europe that he has or that he remembers is not the on-the-ground Europe of today.
It's amazing to me, though, the inferiority complex that left-wing intellectuals have as Americans, that they're just embarrassed. They're embarrassed by the red states, and they're embarrassed by the gun culture. And I'm so sorry, European counterparts. I just wish we could be more like you. But unfortunately, we have these hicks and yahoos, and the best we can do is every 4 years try and keep them in line and humiliate them. And I think in the present, right now, it's under cover of caring profoundly about their health, it's become a matter of we're going to destroy their livelihoods. We're going to take away things that are dear to them. We will really, really let them have it. But of course, this is for their health. I'm sure there are some people who even have tricked themselves into thinking that that's their motivation, because we're very good at fooling ourselves. But to me, I think it's pretty obvious that at this point, the regime is simply punishing its enemies. Enemies that embarrass them around the world, and enemies that won't just shut up, get in line, and do what celebrities in Hollywood tell them to do.
Well, it's interesting, too. I have to go search for pictures of the French taking to the streets in protest over different COVID regulations and mandates. And those stories aren't just on our media. We don't see that Paris is flooded with protesters who are opposing all kinds of COVID restrictions. And we don't see that in our news stories, because they don't want us to think, oh, well, if the French can do it, we should be flooding our streets too.
Of course, that's the Europe I want to emulate, are those exactly. Europeans in the streets, but that's not fashionable.
But that's the Europe that Breyer overlooks, and that's the Europe that's on the rise. That's where Europe is headed, and it still, I think, is currently dominated by its elite class, but the surge in populism is going to change that.
What do you think of the claim that the Supreme Court, now maybe it's an ought claim rather than an is claim, but that the Supreme Court it's apolitical. It's above the hurly-burly world of politics. And that it consists of 9 people who are impartially contemplating abstract ideas sitting upon a platonic mountaintop. I guess I'm stacking the deck here with your answer.
Well, I guess what I dislike about judicial interpretive modes that elevate judges to platonic guardians is I do not like, and this you see this in the 14th Amendment. So a lot of libertarians just love the 14th Amendment because they believe it gives jurists a mechanism for striking down state laws that they find to be unfriendly to liberty. Well, I don't know very many federal judges, let alone Supreme Court justices throughout history, who are very libertarian at all. So when a court is going to say and incorporate the Bill of Rights against the states and start striking down state laws, I don't see it doing it in ways that are going to be friendly toward libertarian views. A lot of libertarians point to Locker and the freedom of contract there, but that's sort of a one-off example. And there's some other examples they can point to too. But all of this sidesteps a very conceptual problem, which is that you are concentrating and centralizing power when you argue for that sort of mode. And you are suggesting that this small pocket of people ought to have the power to overturn the legislative prerogatives of the various states in a very frightening way. I find that to be very contrary to libertarian at a fundamental level. It is all about centralizing power and concentrating power rather than dispersing or diffusing power. And maybe you can point to a few instances, for example, you know, the right of interracial couples to marry or something like that. But on the whole, I think that sets a dangerous precedent, because you don't know how this centralized body is going to use that power. And I don't think that federal judges or Supreme Court justices are these great platonic guardians who are well-read in all sorts of history and philosophy. They're not the types that I would trust to babysit my children, let alone make decisions about issues that affect my everyday life.
Well, I agree with you about the centralizing libertarians who have an illusion that ideally we would have really good judges who would just impose libertarian ideas as often as possible. I think the far better approach is to limit the power of judges to the extent possible, rather than do that. But what I guess I had in mind is, I think the regime has been trying to convince people that when the Supreme Court, particularly when it's in the hands of people they themselves trust, when the Supreme Court issues a decision, this is the Constitution. This is the result of people impartially examining the case before them and the text of the Constitution. And now, of course, they will say that this gets perverted because crazy right-wing judges bring their crazy agenda to the court. But they're trying to make it seem that these are not mere politicians on the court, that they don't have political concerns of their own. They're simply impartially examining the cases before them. Now, that just seems ludicrously implausible to me. And Robert Barnes said the other day that if you look at judges appointed by the various presidents, you know, you can kind of predict where they're going to go. But with the Obama judges, you can really predict where they're going to go because they just always side with the regime. Every single time, they'll take the government side, time after time. Whereas there's at least some variety among the other ones. I was just wondering about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, there's a limiting principle to originalism and textualism that will require some judges on the right to side with parties they disagree with because the text of a statute or the Constitution, as the case may be, pushes them in one direction. However, on the left, where there is not really a limiting principle, where it is living constitutionalism or whatever the theory is, it sort of pick your end conclusion. It's results oriented. Pick where you want to go and then figure out a rationale later. And how do you get to that? How do you achieve that goal? And that is a highly political argument. Now, Supreme Court justices, federal judges, you know, these are political appointments. And the people who get chosen to fill these positions have demonstrated their loyalty to some political party or another along the course of their career. So the fact or the suggestion that these federal judges or Supreme Court justices are just entirely apolitical is absurd. I mean, these people are highly political and always have been. I mean, just look at Marbury v. Madison, where Marshall gives the Jeffersonian Democrats what they want, but also establishes judicial review. I mean, it's a very acrobatic move, and it was highly political. And those sorts of things happen throughout history. And John Roberts is a perfect example. He's somebody who tends to do what is politically expedient rather than on principle. I mean, Justice Thomas is somebody that is consistently ruling on principle, and Alito as well. But all of these figures have their own political assumptions and proclivities that they come to the bench with, and to pretend that they aren't there is mistaken.
Do you have an opinion on where the Supreme Court might, this is not fair of me to ask you, but who cares?
It's okay.
You're trapped on my show. There's no escape.
There's no escape.
I've heard Barnes, I think, say that he thinks, now maybe I'm wrong, and if I'm wrong, I'll correct it, that he thinks that they'll overturn the mandates, the vaccine mandates.
Oh, on the vaccine mandates, I do not know where they're going to go. I thought you were going to ask me about the Dobbs case, the Jackson Women's Health Organization case in Mississippi on the abortion. But no, the oral argument on those vaccine mandates is scheduled for January 7th. And I really don't know because I think those mandates are supposed to take effect on like the 10th and oral arguments on like the 7th. So just as a practical matter, I don't know how that will work. Now, the other side of that is how are these things going to be enforced? I'm at Troy University, which is a state institution. Auburn and Alabama have decided to follow the federal mandate, whereas our university has decided to follow a contrary mandate, which is a state mandate, which says that we're not supposed to follow the federal mandate. So, I mean, what entity is going to come in, let's say that they don't overturn the vaccine mandates? What entity is going to come in and tell us that, you know, tell Troy that we need to change? I don't know. Troy may make an internal decision about that, but is the U.S. Attorney's Office going to come in and tell us no?
Yeah, but maybe they'll say something like students there won't be eligible for federal student loans or something.
Well, that may be what they'd have to do. You know, that's sort of how the federal government operates with all the federal largesse. You know, it's that way with the drinking age, you know, and you're not getting federal dollars for your roads if you're not going to raise the drinking age. It's not like 21 is in the Constitution or something like that. So yeah, it's that carrot that the federal government gets to dangle. And in particular with federal student loans, that's a carrot and stick game that gets played all the time in higher education.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. So, all right. Well, that, to me, that really is the key thing, because now they're talking about maybe they would say that so-called unvaccinated people can't fly on airplanes. And I think if the mandates are overturned, then I don't see how that they're going to say, oh, but however, we can restrict you from flying. I think if one goes, the other goes. But I don't know if they're going to try the other one. I don't know if that's a bluff meant to pressure people into getting the shot. I don't know. But I don't know if interstate commerce would be in. I don't know what the deal would be there.
Well, and the thing with right to travel is that is deeply embedded in our constitutional tradition now. It's hard to restrict freedom of mobility. And that's not just part of our constitution, but the Universal Declaration of Human Rights talks about people having the right to freedom of movement and the residence of borders within states and the ability to be able to travel. And so, I mean, unless there's some sort of restriction on, I mean, it's different because airplanes are a common carrier. So it's one thing to say you can't get on a plane than it is to say you can't cross state lines in your own car while you're driving. But regardless, my point in bringing this up is, you know, this is tiptoeing into a very dangerous area and one in which we have a long history and tradition regarding freedom of movement between, you know, private people in different states.
This is, I mean, I'm able to be just an observer when it comes to the vaccine mandates because it doesn't affect me. I don't work for a company with 100 employees. I don't work for any company, so it doesn't affect me. Yeah. But I still fight against them because it affects other people. But this really would affect me. I enjoy flying. You know, I enjoy traveling. I don't, well, let's just say, I don't enjoy every aspect of the flying process. I enjoy getting to point B. I enjoy opening the door and being at point B. I enjoy that. I wonder what kind of pushback there would be because there's been shockingly little pushback in these matters. And I know that the airlines don't want it. They actually do not want this. But maybe they just keep getting federal bailouts. I don't.
Well, that's the thing. They'd have to get the federal bailouts, and you know, because it would definitely reduce the number of customers they get. So they'd have to be relying on those federal bailouts again.
And I would absolutely deny them the bailouts. And it's a shame. It's a shame because if they wind up suffering, it's not entirely their fault. I mean, honestly, are they just going to shoot down FAA people who show up to correct them? I mean, what is the solution there? So it's the fault of the government. But as I say, let's hope it doesn't come to that. And it seems like the narrative is shifting or collapsing even as we speak. But maybe as it's collapsing, maybe one final gasp would be an extreme measure like this. Very hard to predict where these people are going to go.
It really is.
We've just got a little bit of time left. And you have in your part of your book on culture, I feel like this could also be called miscellaneous because you have so many different topics under this heading. There's so many different topics under this. So socialism, world's greatest generator of poverty. Okay, well, that's the kind of thing I might expect to read in a book like this. But then ideas make us rich, In Search of Fascism, The Conservative Mindset, Ron Paul's Education Revolution. There's an awful lot here. If I had to somehow challenge you to say, in the midst of this extremely diverse array of topics in this section, could you identify a thread running through them?
I think so. I mean, I think that I am an advocate of decentralization, diffusion, and dispersal of power, as I've mentioned earlier. And I am the type of person like a Bradley Berzer who likes to sort of wed social conservatism and libertarianism. And I don't see those things as mutually exclusive at all. And I like to look at custom and tradition and the historical record. I'm very historical in my thinking. I am not ahistorical. I know we've talked or you've talked on the show quite a bit about, you know, Straussian views. And I find that to be of akin with Gnosticism and very ahistorical. And I tend to find that all knowledge that we gather is inherited through a deep textual network. And that, you know, without reading, your only knowledge is derived from your present experience, the things you see or hear or taste or touch. But that experience lacks context. You really need to read great books, philosophy, literature, history, in order to give yourself the context to understand your own moment.
What do you think libertarianism can, how do you think libertarianism can benefit from engaging with mature conservatism?
Well, for a lot of reasons. I mean, number one is just figuring out where there were alliances. I know you recently had a show on the old right and looking at the anti-war tradition and among the old right figures is one place where you can say, okay, here's here's a rich historical tradition. Here are some points of agreement. Here are some places where we might make alliances, but also just at a basic level of humility. When you're reading, you're exercising faculties while, understanding more deeply the perennial features of the human condition if you're reading the right stuff. But reading good and challenging and complex works, some of the most important works that have ever been written, also trains you into humility, because gradually you recognize that elements of your own thoughts and the writings of people who lived long ago, you find elements of your own thought there. And you discover that although you're unique, you're not that unique. And that can lead you to be a more civil and contemplative person. And I think that that humility is something that we libertarians tend to lack, and I include myself in that too. We tend to jump to our position of certitude because we have read. I mean, libertarians, to get to where we get, we're such a unique group of people that to arrive at our positions, we've had to do a lot of studying and we've had to go against the culture in a lot of ways. But having arrived there, I think it's still important for us to learn to ask questions and to embrace a healthy skepticism rather than complacently accepting all of our beliefs as unconditionally true. It's always good to be somewhat provisional about what you believe so that you can adapt in light of new information. And I actually have tried my hardest to be like that and have become more libertarian over time. And I believe it's because of having an open mind that I'm able to make those sorts of pivots.
Well, the book we've been discussing is Shouting Softly, Lines on Law, Literature, and Culture by our guest, Alan Mendenhall. Well, Alan, I enjoy reading the things you write. And as I say, I'm glad to see that your career continues to progress so well and that you're able to actually keep up despite all the craziness. You're still able to travel and speak to people and get the word out about important ideas. That's great to see. So congratulations on that. I'll link to the book at tomwoods.com/2034 for folks who'd like to take a look. And thanks again.
And thank you. And congrats on exceeding that 2000 mark. I saw photos of that event and it looked like quite an event.
That's very kind of you to say. It was indeed very memorable. Thank you. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for 2021 for the Tom Woods Show. So my sincere thanks to everyone who's been listening, who's been helping me spread the word about the show, who's been supporting the show through the supportinglisteners.com site, everybody who's sent me good wishes, who came out to the 2000th episode, all of you who have given me moral support, I appreciate it very, very much. And here's hoping 2022 is the year when we free ourselves of our shackles once and for all. We are kicking off the year January 3rd, the first weekday of the year, with a Michael Malice week that I very much hope you'll enjoy. Thank you very, very much, everybody. I hope you have a great 2022.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.